You're listening to the Free Oromia podcast, dedicated to amplifying the voices of freedom. Thanks for tuning in to the Free Oromia podcast. Visit our website at freeoromia.org. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Team Free Oromia, and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Team Free Oromia. You can also give us a call on the Free Oromia podcast hotline at 430-755-0727 and leave us a voicemail asking us questions or giving us your feedback. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome to the Free Oromia podcast, a podcast dedicated to amplify the voice of freedom. Jal Moro, control yourself over there. I'm trying to get this thing kicked off. Well, as we always do, we'll start by introducing our infamous hosts. We have the one and only.
What did we do to deserve that or earn that?
We have the very known, probably future astronaut, Jal Ango.
Oh, okay. That's a new one. Thanks.
Science.
I'm always trying to find different careers that is very unique to people that are achieving in the future. And then we have Jal Moro, who I think doesn't need any further introduction, but she is expected to find the cure to prolonging our life. I don't know. I'm going to stop.
Oh my goodness. I'm speechless.
Okay. Say hi, Jal Moro.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back.
Awesome. Hey. Awesome. I wish I could say the same to you.
Ouch. Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Okay. I'm used to it.
It's a struggle out here.
I'm used to it. This is the thanks I get for showing up today.
No fighting. Okay.
Awesome. No, we love each other, really.
Yeah, definitely. So, today we're going to be discussing about the role of investigative research and report writing in Oromia. We'll be talking about how essential investigative research and report writing is to tell our story and to document the horrendous human rights abuses and crimes against humanity being committed against the Oromos on their own land. And to do this, we had our very own Jal Ango conduct an interview with Dr. Trevor Truman, who is the director of a long-standing human rights group, Oromia Support Group, which has been documenting and publishing human rights reports for decades.
Yeah, so Dr. Trevor Truman, or Obogalato, as he's also known, is a family doctor from the UK who helped to train Oromo health workers in refugee camps in Sudan and in OLF-held areas of Wollaga from 1988 to 1991. So he was present in Wollaga when the Derg fell in 1991. And he's reported and campaigned on human rights in Ethiopia since then, writing 54 reports thus far on abuses in Ethiopia for the Oromia Support Group. And he started doing that in 1994, or the group started doing that in 1994. So he's interviewed hundreds of Oromo refugees in Europe and North America and Africa to compile the information that has been put into these reports over the years. And he's just recently released the latest one.
Awesome. On behalf of our listeners, I want to thank Dr. Trevor for taking the time to do this interview and share with us his work. This interview with Dr. Trevor speaks on the latest Oromia Support report, one of the 54 that they have worked on, and this one is titled "The Empire Strikes Back," which charts the exponential growth of brutal killings of innocent Oromo civilians by the Ethiopian government. The interview also gives a glimpse into the OSG into the how the OSG was founded, the history, and how it collects its information, and also Dr. Trevor's comparative perspective on human rights abuses across various Ethiopian regimes. Before we get into the interview, I want to take this opportunity to plug in our social media. Please follow us on IG and Twitter at Team Free Oromia. And also please visit our website at www.freeoromia.org and make sure to take our survey. Now let's jump into the interview.
Hello, Obogalato, and thank you for being here with us today on the Free Oromia podcast.
Baganagan Luegdan, and it's a joy to be here. Thank you very much. Baye Galatomi.
Baganagan Nugese. Let's just get straight into the questions about Oromia Support Group and Report 54 that has been released this month by the organization. So if I could start by asking you to tell us a bit about the Oromia Support Group, what the organization is and what it does.
Of course. It began in 1994 when Oromo friends of mine in London, Dimesi Tulu and Mohamed Kitesa, suggested that we form a group not only of Oromo but including expats as well, because nobody was listening to complaints of human rights abuses going on ever since the TPLF came to power. In fact, the abuses began in 1991 before the OLF were forced out of the transitional government. And so we were looking at abuses from 1992, although we started publishing only in 1994. And between 1994 and 2013, we produced 49 reports of human rights abuses in Ethiopia. And to begin with, we were getting lots of reports, but information began to dry up as the TPLF got better and better at controlling the information flow, and it became similar to what it is now in terms of information getting out. But then from 2010 to 2013, I was interviewing refugees in various countries in Africa, Djibouti, Somaliland, Kenya, Egypt, and South Africa. And I was able to get a lot of stories from those refugees. And then when it was the Kero Kare time, 2014 onwards, when they were achieving fantastic things over the next 3 years or so, and OSG was quite quiet at that time. But then after the new regime came to power in 2018, when I was there in Finfine on the day that the OLF came back, and it was a really jubilant occasion. The atmosphere was electric. Everybody was so happy, and millions on the streets of Finfine, and it was wonderful. Anyhow, as we know, since then the abuses have started happening again, and in spades this time. They're really accelerating, and so I felt that we really had to start publishing reports again. And so in July 2019, we did report number 50. And now we've just done 54 in the first week of January. It was released. And over the 20 years that we were reporting abuses by the TPLF, we managed to record details of something like 4,500 extrajudicial killings. But since October 2018, when the present bout of killings began, we've recorded 1,342 killings in that short time. So within a tenth of the time that we were recording under the TPLF, we've got a third the number of killings that we had in the whole of the 20 years with the TPLF. We're seeing abuses on a scale hitherto not seen by me at any time during the TPLF, although 92-93 was a particularly hideous time for OLF supporters, and they were treated then as Kero Kare people and OLF and any Oromo institution now is being treated. It's very similar then. It began with the OLF and then spread to other political parties and then to Oromo involved with NGOs. The Oromo Relief Association was shut down, and anybody involved in business or development organizations that were tilted towards the Oromo, that were helping Oromo, found themselves in trouble. And exactly the same things happen now. The number of killings, as I say, we've recorded 1,342. And since then, we've had records of, I think it's 287 killings in Benishangul Gumuz reported by Al Jazeera, and another 30 or so Oromo killed in December from a report by the Oromo Menschenrechts und Hilfs Organisation in Germany. The killings are all over Oromia, but we're only getting very patchy information, both geographically and temporally. There are whole periods that we don't hear much about, and there are whole areas that we don't get information from, at least for a while. And we're seeing a pattern of abuses across Oromia, where anybody who is in any way associated or suspected to be associated with an Oromo body, especially the OLF or Oromo Federalist Congress or an Oromo media organization, OMN, ONN, any of these people are liable to be arrested and killed. We're still getting reports from 2019, but the records coming in do seem to show that the numbers being killed has really accelerated. Overall, now we've reported 505 killings in 2019, and that includes 100 Kimant in Amhara region and 150 Sidama in the Southern Nations, Nationalities and Peoples region. And then in 2020, we've got 837 killings. So 1.5 times as many, at least that. And as I say, we're still getting reports coming through. And that included 58 Walaita people in Southern Nations, Nationalities and Peoples region, and 60 Amhara settlers in Guliso. We know that these were killed by government. They certainly weren't killed by the Oromo Liberation Army, as the media have claimed. And more worrying, really, is the decay that we've seen in the judicial system. The TPLF were no friends of the judiciary at all, but there was a degree of independence amongst the judiciary. It wasn't good, but it wasn't as bad as it is now. We're getting judges coerced into making decisions against opponents of the regime, and they're being dismissed from their post, and they're also being detained. We didn't see judges actually put in prison under the TPLF, and this is against the constitution, by the way. Unless caught in the act of committing a crime, judges should not be put in prison. And we're seeing a scale of killing not seen since the Red Terror, really, and it in the 1970s, 1977-78, and young people are being taken out of detention in police custody and just murdered and thrown into the bush. Now, that sort of thing we saw occasionally under the TPLF, but not on the present scale. It is very reminiscent now of what the Derg were doing in the Red Terror. So that's basically the report and how it fits in with the other report that OSG has done.
So how does the OSG go about collecting information on human rights abuses in Oromia? I know you mentioned that it can be a little bit tricky, and information is still dribbling in from last year and even 2 years ago. So how is that information collected?
It's collected by mainly two individuals who have extensive contacts across Oromia, especially in the West. One of the individuals who now lives in Norway has been sending us information since the 1990s when he was working for Urgi newspaper and was part of an organization called Gedado, Agony, which was sending information to us from Oromia to England in printed form originally and then eventually by email. This gentleman in Norway was part of the team that was collecting stuff, collecting information about abuses back then in the 90s in Ethiopia. And like a lot of the people that were sending us information, he ended up as a refugee himself and now lives in Norway. But he has maintained contact with lots of people across Oromia. And so these are, well, I won't tell you how, but information filters through to him. Also, there's an individual in Melbourne, Australia, who's part of the OSG team, who collects information. He gets some information via political contact. And also, we cooperate with the German-based organization, OMRO, Oromo Menschen Rechts und Hilfsorganisation, which is based in Hanover, and the Human Rights League for the Horn of Africa, which is Goroma Wakesa's a band of people in Toronto. He was working in Urgi newspaper and set up the Human Rights League in Finfine back in 1997. And then he and two others were in prison for 3.5 years because they'd done just that.
Right.
So we get information from four sources, two mainly. Mm-hmm. And they get their information from lots of different people all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we want to be set up to get more information from people on the ground in Oromia. As long as it's good, solid information, with details of places, names, and exactly what's happened, then we can publish.
Right, okay. I mean, you've mentioned that there are serious risks, actually, for people on the ground to providing information to your
That's
organization.
True. And this was true under the TPLF as well. Mm-hmm. I remember one youngster being killed because he had a letter in his pocket, a copy of a letter that he'd sent to OSG.
Wow.
And he was shot dead in Woolloongabba.
Wow.
I think he was only 16. So, yeah, it's a dangerous job, and it always has been.
That's a very terrifying reality, to know that, you know, when you're trying to report on human rights abuses, then that puts you at risk of being killed, and I guess that is one of the major challenges that you have in terms of being able to collect information. But what other sort of obstacles do you tend to face in trying to obtain the information from Ethiopia?
There are some logistical problems in terms of getting information written in a form which is reproducible, and the spellings of names and things like this. It makes it very difficult to check and cross-check whether you've reported things before or not. And so that does mean that quite a lot of the time when writing a report is spent reading through old reports, making sure we haven't reported this killing or that killing before. Mm-hmm. And that does take a good deal of time.
That's very interesting. And I mean, considering these difficulties in regards to obtaining information, to what extent do you think that human rights violations in Ethiopia and in Oromia are actually being documented? Like, how much of it is actually being caught, so to speak?
It's impossible to tell. We certainly know that there are some areas where we're getting no information at all, and it would be most unlikely that those were free of human rights abuse. Judging by the number of times we get the same incident reported by different sources, I would say, I would guess that we don't get more than a quarter of what's going on, and possibly less than that, possibly less than 5%, I don't know. But I would be very surprised if we got more than a quarter of the incidents of killing recorded, certainly no more than half. It's a shocking thing, I know, but when I was interviewing refugees in, well, in Kenya and Djibouti, Somaliland, as I said before, and South Africa and Egypt, that's right. And the number of times I was told about things that I'd just never heard of before, you know, people being killed in this village or that village, and we have no record of it from years before with OSG. And you only really get to know what's happening to people when you talk to a lot of people who live in the countryside. And that's, you know, where a lot of the abuses occur.
Exactly. Okay. So as you've been producing these reports on human rights violations in Ethiopia for some decades now, how would you say that the current wave of abuses compares to those that you've reported on in the past?
Yeah. In general, it's not a good idea to compare regimes in terms of abuses, because the types of abuse may be different as well as the amount of abuse. And you can do a lot more harm by not educating people, perhaps, for 10 years than you can by killing. Who knows? So it's different. It's difficult to say one regime is worse than another. But in my experience of reporting abuses under the TPLF, abuses under the present regime do appear to be different, as well as the scale of abuse, which does seem to be greatly elevated compared to the TPLF, as well as the scale. The attacks on the judiciary seem to be more serious, as I said earlier. More people have been taken out of custody and just killed and thrown away. But also the types of torture and mistreatment are different. It's not so subtle now. It's more crude. We're seeing people being mutilated after they've been killed, or perhaps before they're killed. People with eyes being gouged out, throats cut, heads being removed from bodies, genitalia cut off. This is the sort of thing we didn't see so much of under the TPLF. So the brutality of it seems to be one level worse, if you like. And also the frivolous nature of some of the abuses. We're getting housewives shot dead as target practice. Amsalu Gudete in Anfilo. She was in her compound when a soldier just boasted that he could shoot her dead with one shot. So he did. And just to boast to his colleagues that he was that good a shot. Lady in Diridawa shot when going out to get breakfast for her children. Yakuta Ahmed. This sort of frivolous killing, it shows what little value Oromo lives have to the current regime. And the raping, gang raping of little girls and young boys by soldiers in military camps. I mean, it's the sort of stuff you'd think of that the Romans used to do. It's really prehistoric, this level of abuse. It's medieval.
And your latest report actually is quite aptly named The Empire Strikes Back, and the nature of these types of abuses, I suppose, are reminiscent of the kind of horrendous torture that used to take place during the time of the Ethiopian Empire, during the time of the emperors.
During the expansion under Menelik, yeah, especially. Yeah, yeah. Well, the Enola massacre was a particularly ugly affair. But there are two scholars who reckon that the population of Oromia was reduced from 10 million to 5 million during the expansion of Menelik the Third. And second, sorry, Abiy Ahmed is Menelik the Third, isn't he?
He does fancy himself as such, doesn't he?
Well, I'm baffled, really. The TPLF, they established a federal system to suit their purposes, because they wanted a degree of autonomy within a federal Ethiopia. And after abusing the rest of the empire for 20-odd years, they retreated back to Tigray. And now we have the former masters taking over again, the Amharas. We shouldn't say Amharas, because it's not all Amharas, is it? It's the urban elites, the power-hungry people who happen to be Amhara, that now want to take us back even further, even more primitive than the TPLF. So that I was trying to liken it to dinosaurs the other day, and the TPLF would be like Tyrannosaurus Rex, a more modern dinosaur. But Abby wants to take us back to the days of empire with a unitary state, a monolithic state. And this is even more old-fashioned. This is more like Stegosaurus, which is already a fossil by the time Tyrannosaurus was on the planet. So Abby Ahmed is taking us back to the early dinosaur period instead of the later dinosaur period, if you like. It's amazing that such crude political positioning should be taking place now at this day and age, when with the growth of democracy and respect for human rights across the planet, we're having an old system of dictatorship where you have a unitary state imposed on your people and kept that way by violence. That's not the way to go on. It's perfectly obvious that's an unstable setup and cannot and will not work. And just because Abiy had a dream when he was a teenager that he was going to be king of Ethiopia, like Boris Johnson being king of the world or whatever, then he's a dangerous man with a messianic vision, as far as I can see. And people who feel they're right and righteous are often very dangerous.
That's very true. And I suppose it's a state that's rebelling against changing times in a desperate attempt to remain what it always has been.
It was already out of kilter with the modern world in the time of Haile Selassie. Mm. And ever since then, it's not really progressed. Mm. We've still got the same colonial mentality, and there's still the racist ideology that underpins it. And you've only got to mention the word Fin Fine in Fin Fine, and depending on where you're from, if you're a Romo, people nod and say okay, but people spit at you if they're Amhara. You use the word Fin Fine, it's detested. And the hatred felt in both ways, by Amharas to Oromo and the other way around, is really the problem that's got to be addressed. Otherwise, we've just got more and more decades of disaster ahead of us. The old-fashioned way of doing things, this zero-sum, winner-takes-all mentality, which is part of Amhara, part of the old Abyssinian culture, that don't work anymore. And we've got to do it the Oromo way. The Oromo way, as you know, is not zero-sum, winner-takes-all. It's compromise, dialogue, concessions, working it out, agreeing by consensus how to do things, not dominating one opinion over another. And it's a true democracy, as you know, with the Gada system, as was. This is the way we ought to be approaching the situation in Ethiopia, not this belligerent fighting way, and just depending on violence and how strong you are.
My next question was actually going to be how you foresee the problems of human rights violations in Oromia being solved, but I suppose you've already addressed that, essentially, doing it the Oromo way.
No, we don't know how it's going to be resolved. I know how I would like to see it resolved. I would like to see a new transitional setup, a new transitional government of Ethiopia, with all interested parties having an equal voice in the running of the country, if it's going to remain a country. I think it's a fundamental human right, and part of the one of the articles, the 30 articles of the Universal Declaration, that people are entitled to self-determination. They should be able to decide what form of government they have, what sort of structure, and who runs that structure, who is in charge of it. And that's just, to me, it's common sense. But appears not to be common sense to the forces in power in Ethiopia at the moment.
I mean, I suppose they're not operating according to sense or reason. They're operating according to what's going to maintain their position of power and privilege. I guess expecting reason from them.
Yes, I suspect the majority of Amhara, let's use that as a shorthand for urban elites who want a united Ethiopia, but I suspect the majority of Amhara are more conciliatory than what the media would portray. And I think we've got to reach out to these people. Initially, when Abiy Ahmed came to power, he was backed by all sorts of people queuing up to sing his praises, including lots of mature, educated, and politically wise Amharas. They're not so vocal now in terms of their support of Abiy Ahmed. And that's obviously why, just like, you know, Republicans refusing to back Donald Trump eventually. And eventually Abiy Ahmed will be left high and dry with a few nutcases behind him who are calling for the OLF to be wiped out and for all Oromo youth to be knocked on the head, these sorts of things. And that will be the rump of Abiy Ahmed, and he will be put in the rubbish bin of history, hopefully. A new transitional setup could work. It didn't, it wasn't perfect under the TPLF, but it was a damn sight better than what we got now. I know in Free Oromia you would push for an independent Oromia, and I can respect that point of view, although I have a different one myself. But you certainly don't want to go back to the days of Stegosaurus and the old zero-sum stuff for the whole of Ethiopia. Menelik III, we do not want. Thank you very much.
No, thank you. Never. So, what are the sort of future plans for OSG? And what can our listeners do to help support the work of the organisation?
I thought I was going to retire. In fact, I looked up a biography the other day for one of these interviews, and I found that I'd written 2 years ago, Dr. Truman has now given up campaigning work and is concentrating on nature conservation work. And as you can see, I've been dragged back into this now. The future for OSG, we have already got connections with many people within Ethiopia who are very keen to promote human rights, and we are forming closer and closer ties with those people. And eventually, when there is a Free Oromia, whether it's an independent Free Oromia or part of a federal setup, then it would be wonderful if we could have something similar to the literacy campaign of the DERG, where instead of students going out into the countryside teaching people to read and write, we taught them about human rights And so that everybody in every village, in every kibele, knew that what was right and what was wrong in terms of how to treat people. And have a system of reporting so that nobody feels in the country, nobody in any village anywhere feels they haven't got somewhere to turn to if their rights are being abused. So you can set up a reporting system and a cataloguing system of abuse. That would be my vision of the future. How we get there? Well, it depends on Abiy Ahmed and his followers and the amount of international support they get. We could be heading for a disastrous scenario on the lines of Rwanda writ large. That would be the worst case scenario. We could have a negotiated settlement with the establishment of a new transitional government tomorrow. That would be the best case scenario. Somewhere in between, we're going to get a variable number of people killed. And the sooner we get a negotiated settlement and the people grow up and start sorting things out the Oromo way, until that, then people are going to die. And more and more and more people are going to die. But if we play our cards right, keep control of our emotions, then hopefully we will be able to set an example that will, well, put the whole of the Horn of Africa on a better footing. Once you've got human rights for the Oromo, you get human rights for Ethiopia. Once you get human rights for Ethiopia, you get them for the Horn of Africa.
I think that's a great sentiment to finish on. I guess to conclude, maybe if you could tell us where we can find out more about OSG, where we can read the reports, where we can get in touch. Where can we reach you?
The Oromia Support Group, thanks to friends in England and in America, has now again got a functioning website. So if you look up oromiasupport.org, you will be able to gain access to every one of the 54 reports that we've written on human rights abuses in Ethiopia. That website will eventually have much more information on, including stuff for asylum seekers. But at the moment, we're very proud to have the archive of OSG reports there. That's a historical document of what went on under the TPLF, and we are documenting what's going on under Abiy Ahmed now. So the future is cooperation with indigenous bodies in Ethiopia and setting up a human rights network that can withstand future regimes. That's the ideal.
Okay, that's fantastic. And actually, just before we do finish, in case our listeners wanted to contribute to the work that you do in a more direct way, if perhaps they have contacts back home who could potentially provide information for the OSG reports, is there a possibility for them to be able to connect
Absolutely.
You with people?
Yep. info@osgaustralia.com. It is as simple as that.
Okay.
And we will welcome reports of human rights abuses if they're organised and accurate. But don't send us things that you think may have happened. It's got to be rock solid stuff, and preferably more than one source. But we don't insist on that all the time. Times, places, dates, names, and what went on. It's just basic stuff. But we do need as much of that information as possible.
Thank you very much for sharing that. And thank you very much for being here with us today. I was going to say we look forward to seeing more of your work, but actually we hope we get to a place where you no longer need to do your work.
I think yes, look forward to seeing you out of work completely.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. We look forward to seeing you retire.
Well, I must say, having seen the strength and of the Oromia movement, the Oromo movement over the years, and the involvement of people, I must say that I'm very, very encouraged by the amount of enthusiasm, intelligence, and wisdom amongst the younger Romo that I've been privileged to be in contact with. And I'm very confident of the future for Oromia. As Nagasa Kumsa said, the Oromo people are like a big, huge cooking pot that takes a long, long time to get cooking, but you're cooking. And once you're cooking, there's no stopping it.
Well, there you go. Let's close out on those words. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Nagati, bye now.
Once again, very, very grateful for that amazing interview, Jalango. Also, Jal... shall I say, what's his Jal name? Did we give him a Jal name? I think we didn't. So, doctor, we'll keep it with Dr. Trevor.
Yeah, let's stick with Obogalato, maybe.
Or Obogalato.
Yeah,
yes,
we can stick with Obogalato, yeah.
Yeah, so thank you, Obogalato. Please support them. One way you would support that organization is by sharing their reports. Go to their website, read their reports. They're doing that. This is... they're documenting what our people are going through. Their website is www.oromiasupport.org. Also, if you have any information, if it's something valuable and something tangible with good information, please send it to info@osgaustralia.com. They're always looking for human rights abuse information coming out of Oromia.
You know what's funny? What I kind of picked up on. So he goes by either Dr. Trevor or Obogalato. And obviously that's not Western custom or British custom to go by Dr. Trevor, because Trevor's his first name. He would, you know, according to sort of like Western customs, it would be Dr. Truman.
Yes.
But he prefers to be called Dr. Trevor. So he's kind of like picked up
the Oromo. Yeah,
yeah, the Oromo way of...
Orom Sinirage Tuda, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that so much. I love also how he like started things off in Afan Oromo. I was like, okay, Obogalato.
Yeah.
Hey, we need allies, you know, for sure.
Well, I mean, like you mentioned in the beginning of the interview, it was his Oromo colleagues who requested, you know, that he amplifies what's going on in Oromia, kind of thing, so that he... stands beside the Oromo people and uses his sort of access and influence to bring our voices forward. And that's something I appreciate about how he does his work. You know, it's not about speaking on behalf of or overshadowing. It's more about standing besides and amplifying and supporting. So, you know, he does allyship in the proper way. So that's definitely appreciated.
Yeah, I thought it was really fantastic and nice to hear the kind of more detailed reflections from someone who's actually been doing this work for decades and really has been deeply involved with the details of these abuses, because I think, you know, it's one thing for us as consumers of this information to kind of reflect on it, but I guess it's just different when you've been like actively collecting this data for so long. You know, you just have like a deeper sense, you know, and then you hear the things that don't necessarily make it out to the headlines, because I know there's so much information that it's hard to even verify.
These empires and rulers have done such a great job over the years of making sure our story is not being told. So it's so essential to support such efforts and be part of. So, yeah, so it's important for such work to be supported because the regimes are doing these dictators make sure that information flow is cut off or very little. And you can see what's happening in Tigray and stuff. So they've, over the years, they've perfected ways of making sure these stories are not being told. And it's imperative that we support such efforts when people create a channel and get this information out and document these and tell our story, we have to support them. So a really, really big ups to Dr. Trevor.
I appreciated him, underscoring that the reality that these reports don't capture the majority, certainly don't capture all of the human rights abuses, the killings, the arrests that are happening. But as he said, likely less than 25% is captured in these reports. Mm-hmm. And he even said it could be as low as 5%. It's really impossible to tell. I do appreciate that was emphasized because I think for me, that's always like my concern, right? It's hard to cite this information while also citing the fact that we know that it's way more than this. I don't know. It's kind of like that balance between needing things to be documented, but also knowing that if we're only going based off of what's documented, that's massively undershooting what this regime is doing and does not account for all of the lives that are lost at the hands of this government.
It cannot be overstated how essential it is. The human rights organization and researchers that are documenting this lived experiences of the Oromo people and the abuses they're enduring in Ethiopia. It's imperative. We believe that all the people that are facing the state and the militia terrorism in Ethiopia, like the Benishan Gulgun, the people in Tigray, and all the nations and nationalities across, their story needs to be told. And we want, this podcast is really dedicated into making sure our listeners have an opportunity to find resources where you can, educate yourself about these things that are coming out of Ethiopia. Njalmaro is going to, I think, mention a few organizations.
So as you heard in the interview and as we've mentioned a couple times, the Oromia Support Group has been reporting for decades, since 1994. You can find their latest report and their previous reports all conveniently available at oromiasupport.org. They're a very reputable organization, so we're really thankful for the work that they've been doing for so long. Also want to mention UMRO, which in English is the Oromo Human Rights and Relief Organization. UMRO is based in Germany, and Jalango is actually going to give us the actual name of the organization in German.
So it's Oromo Menschenrechts- und Hilfsorganisation. So that's what the abbreviation is based on, the German name.
Mm-hmm. Which is O-M-R-H-O. And then also want to shout out the Ethiopian Human Rights Coalition. Their Twitter account is Ethiopian HRC, which just want to emphasize is not to be confused with Ethio-HRC on Twitter, which is the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, which is... supposedly an independent organization, but it's not. It's essentially a mouthpiece for the government at this point, masquerading as a human rights body. I just wanted to emphasize that because their names are pretty similar and the acronym is kind of the same. So, and then also the Human Rights League of the Horn of Africa. These different groups are doing really, really good work in terms of documenting the human rights abuses that Oromos and other oppressed groups and nations in Ethiopia are facing. And we will include links to all of these resources and groups in our show notes on our website. So visit freeoromia.org/podcast for that.
Mm-hmm. And actually, OSG, OMRO, and the Human Rights League of the Horn of Africa, they actually together form a collective called the Oromia Human Rights Group, if I'm not mistaken. They come together sometimes to put on events, you know, forums, symposia, conferences to discuss human rights related issues in Oromia and in Ethiopia. And they actually very recently held an event which was on the topic of peace, democracy, and human rights and preventing genocide, where they discussed the history and the perspective of elections in Ethiopia, peace and democracy and human rights, of course, as was in the title, the role of the media as well. There was quite a long discussion on the role of media in regards to these issues, and that was very interesting to hear the perspective of the panelists. I think that event is available on OGF's Facebook page, Oromia Global Forum. It was streamed live via their Facebook, so it's available there if anyone's interested in taking a look. But it was a really great event, so I would recommend having a look at that.
Awesome.
Jalmaro, thank you so much for listing those organizations. In this podcast, we really want to amplify the work of these organizations. And it's imperative that we arm ourselves with information, and these websites do that for us. So you can take this and go to your circle and, you know, just educate them and educate yourself of what's happening to our people. And our stories have to be told. You know, one interesting thing when I was listening to the interview was how he mentioned how the Amharas hate toward the Oromos, and he also said vice versa. And I felt, you know, I was like, some part of me wanted to say, you know, no, I disagree with that. But at the same time, there was some truth to it. So was I the only one who felt that emotion, or what did you all think?
I don't think I would have framed it in that way, because I think that there's a lot of nuance to it, and you have to, if you're going to say something like that, I think there needs to be a lot of context behind it, right? Like, I think in terms of what is true from that is, I think that there is some level of animosity from both sides, if we have to frame it that way, as like a both sides thing. But I don't think that the way that animosity takes shape or the nature of it is the same by any stretch of the imagination. So I do think it is very different.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're, you know, rooted in different things. Yeah, you can argue that there's animosity and hostility going in both directions, but the root cause of that are different things for the two groups, I would say. You know, there's one version or type or whatever you want to call it that is structural, and that was constructed for a purpose of oppression and a purpose of marginalization and the purpose of persecution. And then I think,
and it's rooted in supremacy, and it's based on an actual like perpetuated hatred of Oromos as people, like as like who we are.
Exactly. And then I think the other is more of a reaction to that.
Yeah, it's a rejection of that supremacy. It's a rejection of the idea that, you know, we should be treated that way.
Yeah,
there and is honestly, I don't even think it's considered I don't even think it could be considered a hatred. Because, like, ultimately, I don't think that Oromos have any kind of collective hatred of Amhara specifically. It's more of a hatred of the system.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And there's and this like Eurasia, like that we're fighting. You know, when the Oromos feel like they have to defend themselves against, you know, being discounted in Ethiopia or on their own land, versus like you all said, it's a reaction to being demonized or belittled with our very own. Whereas the Oromos reaction is more so, you know, with anger and disappointment of what has happened historically. So the root of the two is completely different. You know, one is to literally eliminate the existence of the other, and that's what it's based on. And the other is, you know, to survive. It's a heavy one, though. It's a very complicated one, for sure.
It is. And we also know that, it like, saying this doesn't mean that all, like, we think all Amharas hate Oromos either. Like, it's just, we're looking at this more at the macro level of the patterns of how this plays out in society. And so I think, you know, if you're listening to this and you feel offended because you're Amhara, or you think, like, you know that Amharas are good people, that's not what we're saying. But we're talking about the type of hatred that's impacting us systemically and is feeding a supremacist ideology and perpetuating systemic violence. So, you know, there's a lot of nuance here, and I hope that people who are listening to this conversation can step outside of their own, like, emotions or reactions for a moment and really reflect on how this is really impacting people and how people feel about this. And, you know, we're coming to the table wanting to really understand these relationships a little bit better. It's not to say that, you know, we're righteous and other people are wrong and hateful. You know what I mean?
For sure. For sure. Yeah, it has to, it could easily be taken out of context. And that's what we're trying to do here, is to give it context and, you know, help people realize that, you know, there is narratives that are being pushed by the elite, and those are what we're trying to counter.
Obviously, because the Amhara identity is being used or co-opted to push the supremacist ideals, then the reaction to that from Oromo people can manifest as hostility towards Amharas, because it's their identity that is being used to push this supremacy.
Yeah, I think that's understandable. And I think we have to understand that these things, like, manifest and impact people in different ways.
Yeah, for sure. But once again, we have to say it, you know, we believe in equality, we believe in democracy, and that's what we're here for, that's what we want to talk about. We don't believe in alienating any specific group or nation. But, you know, these things are tough conversations, but they have to be had. Yeah. Is there any other thing from the interview that stood out for you ladies?
Yeah, I mean, I think some people, I guess, might recognize that Dr. Trevor said that while he does respect our viewpoint that we discuss on this podcast, he doesn't necessarily agree with us in terms of that vision for Oromia's independence. But he did say that, you know, his vision is for Oromia's freedom, whether that means in the context of Ethiopia or as an independent state. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. What did you guys think of that?
I think it's awesome. I mean, it just shows how much our podcast is accommodating and how it's a safe environment for people with different beliefs can come here and voice their opinion. And I, just as he respected our position on sovereign Oromia, you know, we respect his. And, yeah.
I just want to say what matters more than anything is not Dr. Trevor's opinion on Oromia's future, or even our personal opinions on Oromia's future, but it's what the people of Oromia want. And I think the reason why we created this podcast and why we continue to advocate for independence, even in some cases where we're challenged, is because that is what the people of Oromia, the majority, truly want.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we Oromos have different perspectives and we come from a different walk of life. And we have different approaches to Bilisuma and Walabuma. And it's imperative that we respect one another's position and at the same time support one another and then work what we think is best for our people. No, there's no cookie cutter solution to it. There's no one answer to it. We believe that a sovereign Oromia is the answer, but it doesn't mean that we have to impose our beliefs on others, and just the same way others cannot impose their beliefs on us. So I really, I'm happy that we are able to have a dialogue with someone with a completely different perspective and different approach to what we think, you know, is the best solution for our people. But at the end, as long as you're working in the best interest of the Oromo people, we will respect you and we'll stand by you, is my position on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So while I was conducting the interview, there were a couple of things that really stood out to me that I want to highlight a little bit and make sure that our listeners really take away with them about the profoundness of the work that Oromia Support Group does. And at one point, Obugaleto mentioned that a boy was killed because he was carrying a letter that contained information that mm-hmm. he was going to pass on to OSG.
Yeah.
So he was killed for carrying a piece of paper in his pocket. And that's the level of risk and the level of danger that producing these kinds of reports, documenting this kind of evidence comes with. It's actually really dangerous work. It is really, really dangerous work. So, you know, the amount of sacrifices that's going into getting our stories heard and making sure that what's happening to us is known and recorded is immense. And then another thing that really stood out to me and that actually really scared me was how he was describing how the human rights violations now are becoming truly barbaric. Truly, truly barbaric. I mean, he compared it to the Romans. He compared it to the kind of things that go on in medieval times. So it's a really dire state right now. The situation is in a very dire state in Oromia. The human rights situation is in an extremely, extremely dire state.
It's so true. And I think especially with that story of the person who was killed for because he was, you know, going to be sharing the truth. That's the cost of truth in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
And under this mm-hmm. regime, like that is what truth costs. It costs your life. It costs other people's lives. And I think that really underscores the importance and the value of this type of documentation of Oromo stories, the documentation and investigation into the human rights abuses under these dictatorial regimes. And earlier, actually, mm-hmm. we were talking about whether the ongoing work regarding human rights abuses being committed in Oromia is adequate. And it's a really tough question to answer because, I mean, truthfully speaking, no, it's not adequate. But it's not because of the lack of effort on the part of these organizations. It's because of the mm-hmm. fundamental nature of this system, which is dead set against allowing truth to be shared, which is mm-hmm. it thrives on committing these crimes in the dark and in silence. Mm. And that's the mm-hmm. way that it's allowed to continue. And yeah. like we kind of touched on before, even it's so hard, I think, sometimes even sharing this information, because it's like, I don't know, just thinking about all the people that we know are not included in this, and it feels so wrong sometimes. Because, you know, we have these figures, and it really is good to have this information documented, but knowing that what we can tell the world about is only a fraction, it just, you know, it's so hard because it feels like a disservice to all those that really are either suffering or their families are suffering because their lives have been lost in silence and in the dark. And there's something just fundamentally so hard about that. But not to discount the work that they're doing, because without that work, all we would have is like hearsay, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely some profound moments from the interview. And I think one that really irked me and really affected me was when he mentioned how one of the ladies was being used as a target practice.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that just shows you how much value they have for human life and how much value they have for Oromos. You know what I'm saying? Like,
it's no value.
And then what are we doing about that? You know, what are you doing as our listener? What are you doing to make sure that doesn't happen to your people? You know, I think we've armed you all today very well as to how to inform yourself. Again, please, visit their website, the OSD website, which is oromiasupport.org. Also, if you come across some valuable information, valid information about any human rights abuses back home through various resources, send it to them. Their email is info@osgaustralia.com. Again, I want to thank Jal Ango for conducting that interview. I want to thank Dr. Trevor for being part of it. And I want to thank you all for listening to us. Our listeners have been amazing. We've been getting a bunch of reviews. We've even shared it on our Instagram. So thank you. Continue reviewing us. Continue supporting us. And if you have anything you want to say to us, call us or text us on 430-755-0727. Or on our IG and Twitter, which is Team Free Oromia.
OSG, UMRO, the Human Rights League of the Horn of Africa, and the Ethiopian Human Rights Coalition. We're very thankful for doing the work that Western organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have failed to do.
Definitely.
Thanks, y'all.
Extremely.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in.
All right.
See you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
See you. Bye.
Nagat.
Bye. Bye. Naimi makake na ya tchese se fundo fabonto nagama tchese halkanu galgala najala tchese tanjolu masan nadaba tchese oromia.
Yeah, and that's what we were...
Sorry, before you carry on. Sorry. I think my brothers are watching football and they were screaming like crazy. I think you guys heard them, right? Okay, let me just tell them to shut up.
You heard that, right? Yeah, okay, let me go tell them to shut up. I love that.
I wish we could use this on the podcast.
I know,
well,
I wish so too. Are you not
watching? We're using this on the podcast.
That's being used.
She went dure on the man.